Blog Talk Radio. أطمل الليل. أقبل الليل أقبل الليل يا حبيبي يا حبيبي أقبل الليل وأنا وصارت ذكراك طيفا هام في بحر الظنون ينشر الماضي ظلالا كنا Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
أقرأ فيها صفحات بين ماض لم يزالي غير ذكرى عن خيالي عن خيالي لا تغيب بين ماض لم يزالي غير ذكرى عن خيالي عن خيالي لا تغيب وأمالي صورت لي في غد يا حبيب لا حبيب بين ماضي لم يزال غير ذكرى عن خيالي عن خيالي لا وأمالي صورت في غد لك يا حبيب
Thank you.
وحدتي أسامرها حتى ترت فيك نسمة السحر ما زلت في وحدتي أسامرها حتى سرت فيك نسمة السحر.
Welcome back. And that was the music of Egypt, the North African state of Egypt, Umm Kulthum, performing there live in concert. The track entitled Akbal El Lilo, written by Ahmed Rami, and the music composed by Riyad As Sumbati. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, a special worldwide radio broadcast for Sunday, April the 7th, 2024, and we're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. The opera we just heard, Akbal El Lilo, translates into English as The Night Has Approached. The lyrics by Ahmed Rami, sung by Umm Kulthum, that we just heard, say, "The night has approached, my love, and my longing has called me, and your memory passed as a vision, wandering in the sea of my suspicions, spreading out the past in shadows. We were such closeness and beauty, and suddenly my heart set off, longing for the time of sorrows, and suddenly my tears began raining down as my lamentations returned, O guidance of the perplexed in the night of grief. Where are you now? Rather, where am I? I am a fluttering heart in a world of longings. I am a passionate soul in a valley of sorrows. My thoughts strayed between my delusions and the fantasies of my wishes. I do not know, my love, who am I? Where am I?" And that's a section of Akbal El Lilo, which we just heard here at the Pan-African Journal. Right now, we'd like to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment. And these are some of the headlines in today's Pan-African Newswire. Yemen's armed forces has been targeting ships in the Red Sea, the Arabian Sea, and the Indian Ocean, further restricting the siege of Israel. Three cargo ships were targeted in the Red Sea, Arabian Sea, and the Indian Ocean using anti-ship and cruise missiles, the Yemeni armed forces announced on Sunday afternoon. The spokesperson of the Yemeni armed forces, Brigadier General Yahya Sari, said that the operations were conducted in a span of 72 hours prior to the release of a statement detailing the Yemeni armed forces operations. The first ship targeted by the Yemeni armed forces' navy was the UK-owned Hope Island cargo ship, which was stuck using naval missiles and dealt a direct hit in the Red Sea. The last updated position of the Hope Island was 2 days ago, heading southwards towards the Bab al-Mandab Strait. Another series of operations targeted two Israeli-affiliated ships heading to Israel's ports in Palestine. The first, the MSC Grace F, was targeted in the Indian Ocean, while the second, the MSC Jinnah, was targeted in the Arabian Sea. In both operations, the Yemeni armed forces utilized anti-ship ballistic missiles and cruise missiles, successfully achieving their intended objectives. According to maritime tracking websites, the last updated positions of the MSC Grace F was in East Africa, reported 154 days ago. As for the MSC Jinnah, its last updated position was near Sri Lanka some 11 days ago. It is worth noting that Israel-affiliated ships have attempted to conceal their activity in the region by turning off communication and identifying equipment. Sari reiterated that the operations came in support of the Palestinian people and their resistance. And you can read that article in its entirety over the Pan-African Newswire. Also, one of the most prominent writers and thinkers of the Palestinian captive movement, Dakar, was martyred inside the Asaf Harafe Hospital after nearly 4 decades-long struggle in Israeli prisons. Palestinian detainee Walid Dakar was martyred inside the Asaf Harafe Hospital earlier today, following a near 4-decade-long struggle, as we mentioned, in the Israeli prisons. The Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs and the Palestinian Prisoner Society confirmed this a few hours ago. Throughout his imprisonment, Dakar's endured numerous forms of mistreatment, torture, and notably medical negligence. This comes shortly after the human rights group Amnesty International called on Israel to release Dhaka on humanitarian grounds on Saturday. The rights group affirmed that the Palestinian detainee had suffered torture, humiliation, lack of family visits, and medical neglect, particularly since the start of the Israeli war on Gaza on October 7, 2023. On March the 13th, the Palestinian Prisoners Society announced that the cancer-stricken detainee had been transferred to Asaf Harfeh Hospital as his health further deteriorated following deliberate medical negligence. At the time, Dhaka's family made an urgent appeal explaining the urgency of his health situation. The family urged that Dhaka be considered at the top of the list of detainees in the first upcoming exchange deal, given his deteriorating medical conditions. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, a special worldwide radio broadcast. This is the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. The latest Senegalese cabinet features four female members. Recently elected Senegalese Prime Minister Ousmane Sonko has revealed his cabinet lineup comprising 25 ministers and five state secretaries as confirmed by government sources. Senegalese Prime Minister Ousmane Sonko announced on Friday, April 5, 2024, the list of members of his government, which includes 25 ministers and five secretaries of state, the government said in a statement released on Friday. The latest Senegalese cabinet features four women members. Meanwhile, Yassine Fall, notably appointed as Minister of African Integration and Foreign Affairs. General Birame Diop assumes the role of Defense Minister. Ousmane Dagne takes on the position of Justice Minister. General Jean-Baptiste Tine is appointed as Interior Minister. And Biram Solehi Diop is tasked with leading the Energy Ministry as outlined in the official statement. Bassirou Diomaye Faye was sworn in as Senegal's youngest president on Wednesday during the inauguration ceremony that was held in Dakar, the nation's capital. The 44-year-old opposition figure appointed his close ally, Sonko, as the new prime minister. And finally, Rwandan President Paul Kagame expressed that it was the world community that failed Rwanda during the 1994 genocide out of cowardice or contempt. This is the 30th anniversary of the Rwanda genocide. Rwandan President Paul Kagame said respect to the victims of the Rwandan genocide on Sunday, citing that the international community failed his country at that time in 1994. Kagame spoke in Kigali at an event commemorating the 100-day genocide that killed 800,000 people, primarily Tutsis and moderate Hutus, saying his country had been, quote, completely humbled by the magnitude, unquote, of the loss, and that the lessons learned had been, quote, engraved in blood, end quote. It was the international community which failed all of us, whether from the contempt or cowardice, President Kagame said. Kagame's audience included former U.S. President Bill Clinton, who in the past referred to the genocide the biggest failure of his administration. The solemn ceremonies began on April 7th today. Every year they are held and last for a week. Today, Hutu militias began their slaughter in 1994. Kagame laid wreaths on mass graves and lit a remembrance flame at the Kigali Genocide Memorial, where over 250,000 victims are thought to be buried. Each year, additional mass graves are discovered in the country. French President Emmanuel Macron is due to issue a statement and did issue a statement on Sunday saying that France and its Western and African friends could have stopped the killings but lacked the courage to do so. France has emerged as a favorite refuge for individuals involved in the Rwandan genocide seeking to evade prosecution in their home country. Rwanda has criticized Paris for its reluctance to extradite or prosecute these individuals. With that, we'll conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In concluding this segment of our program, we would like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published tens of thousands of articles and dispatches in hundreds of newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. If you'd like to have access to today's Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast for Sunday, April 7th, 2024, all you need to do is log on to the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of our program for this week.
We gotta have peace to keep the world alive and more to see. We gotta have joy. Our hearts with truth, we can't destroy.
Curtis Mayfield, and We Gotta Have Peace, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast. And April 9th is the 126th birthday of Paul Leroy Robeson, and we're going to listen to a rare archival interview with Paul Robeson. And of course, Paul Robeson was one of the Renaissance persons of the 20th century. His involvement in social issues, of course, made him a target of the various government agencies, including the United States Congress, all the way up to the White House. And of course, the impact that his words and his activities had brought about his censorship, going from being one of the most active and well-paid cultural figures in the United States to being essentially red-baited and red-listed and denied access to some of the major concert halls in the United States during the late 1940s. And from that time through the 1950s. So Robeson, of course, is one of the key figures in the whole process of the Renaissance, which took place in Black life during the years
The following program is brought to you by the Pacifica Program Service and Radio Archives.
I have in the studio with me Paul Robeson, who needs no introduction, and Harold Winkler, who is president of Pacifica Foundation, which operates KPFA, as most of you know. Mr. Robeson has been known and loved as an artist all over the world for many years, but he has also, I believe, attracted considerable and worldwide attention in his role as a world citizen and as a person who was very deeply concerned about the society in which he lived. I wonder, Mr. Robeson, if we could kick off by asking, when did you first become involved in the political aspects of...
May I first say how happy I am and privileged to be with you here, and how deeply I thank this station for its kindness throughout the years. I've been on two or three others this time, but always have been, I've had a welcome here, so I want to thank you. I would say, as I indicate in a recent book which is now out, it will be on the stands pretty soon, Here I Stand, Story of My Life as I Tell It, not too autobiographical. It began when I was a little boy in Princeton, New Jersey. Strange to say. Technically, this is the shaping of my views. A Negro boy born in Princeton, New Jersey, in a college town where the students mainly came from the Deep South. You know, Princeton and Princeton, Harvard, and Yale was the sort of the Southern University of the North, whether you know that or not. And so I grew up in Jersey in a rather Southern atmosphere. And my father was a minister, and I was shaped against that background. Technically, I entered the sort of the arena in the United States of fighting for social justice for my people in a concert, when I was in a concert in St. Louis in 1947 in the Post-Dispatch, where I was singing at the Kiel Auditorium, one of the big auditoriums there, and the NAACP asked me in St. Louis at that time to come on a picket line because Negro people could not even sit in the theater, which was just across the street. And so I grabbed a banner, and lo and behold, I saw Walter Houston coming down the street. He was in the play. So Walter walked out and joined the picket line, too. And a few nights later, when I was doing the concert, I said that I could not quite resolve the contradiction between singing to an audience in St. Louis, where there was no segregation, of course, but also the same people had not, to my mind, were not fighting to see that my people could sit in the theater. It's been corrected since. And so I said that I was giving up my career technically for the moment to enter the realm of the day-to-day struggle of the Negro people especially.
And this was your first political action?
That was within this context. This is very important to get into context. My first actual, to come back to your question, was in London in 1933. It isn't very well known, which I clarify in the book, that I went to play Showboat in London in 1928. Jerry Kern was with me and Oscar Hammerstein, and we had a great success. And then I did concerts in 1928, and I became domiciled and lived in England, domiciled there, paid my taxes there from 1928 until 1940, after the war began.
Does this mean, Mr. Robeson, that you spent most of your time in England during this period?
It meant that I came back now and then for concerts. I was here in Oakland many times, but I went back and spent most of my time in Great Britain.
Why?
I was there in 1930, played Othello. So again, this is extremely important. At that time, I said for the public to see that I felt, I would explain it today in this light. We understand why many of my people have come to Oakland, to the vicinity, from Mississippi and from the South. There have been migrations into California, I understand today, from everywhere. But for many years, as you know, many of my people have left the South because the conditions in the North were better. Okay? I felt the pressure so much in 1928 that instead of stopping in New York, I just went on to London. Mm. That clear.
And did you feel no pressure there in
the racial sense? I felt nowhere near the pressure. Now, that does not mean that you haven't the background of the English colonies and so forth.
Yes,
but
I wonder.
Pressure, but I say it's a difference between right here now and, say, let's say the Mississippi of Mr. Eastland. You understand?
Yes.
This is quite different. So America's quite different. There are great differences. So I found England that much more of a difference, that's all. Mm. I found Canada that way. When I was playing Othello some years ago, when we got to Toronto, the cast said to me after a week, well, Paul, why are you so different? The play is much deeper. You seem to be freer. I said, that's quite true. That's quite true. I'm in a country where there is no, this is not a question. I'm on a theater, on a stage with many other white actors. This is not a problem here. So obviously I feel freer, that's right. I mean, I don't feel the pressures that one would feel in the Deep South all the time, but it would interest you to know, and I've put it, that I feel any Negro, if you were honest, would have to say that even in our democracy as at present, that he is never any one second unconscious of the fact that he is a black American or a colored American. He can never be unconscious of it in any part of the United States.
Mr. Robeson, have you been back to England since the last war?
Oh, yes. I was back in 49.
The point I wanted to get at is that when I was in England last year, I became aware of the large number of West Indians who are now London. And I heard rather nasty overtones
in my
talks with some Englishmen that frightened me.
No question
about a change that might take place in England.
No, again, if you want to go further into it, nothing could be worse than South Africa. And I'm only saying, I put these things down. What is most important is that at the height, having lived many years out and enjoying the height of success in Great Britain, that I decided that I must come back to my own country to struggle in this and to make the sacrifices that I have. That's the most important thing in this regard. And I am here.
Now, wait, spell this out again for me? You left England because England is not as attractive or because you feel you have a greater mission in the United States?
No. Let's don't get in that. There are many places in the world where, personally, it would be much easier to live than in the United States for an American Negro.
In other words, your commitment is definitely to what you feel you can do in this country.
That's right. And Langston Hughes, in a book discussion before the book club in New York just a while ago, pointed out that every important Negro novelist, not only Richard Wright, but many others, that the great 95% of them live in Paris or somewhere else in the world. Mm-hmm. Why? Because the pressures personally are much simpler.
And yet in the foreword of your book that I have before me, you quote Frederick Douglass as saying, a man is worked on by what he works on.
That's right.
He may carve out his circumstances, but his circumstances will carve him out as well.
That's right.
Is this part of the reason why you feel that you must be back in the United States?
I made the decision some years ago, and I say certainly that I spring essentially from here. like you threw the other day about the Indians in North Carolina. If you recall, that was in Robeson County.
Yes, I noticed that in the item.
Now, this is a very interesting thing which I point out in my book and which explains a good deal, too, of how I feel. Now, I was born on the edge of Robeson County, and my father is a Robeson and was a Robeson because he was a slave, my own father, a slave of the Scottish Robesons who still control Robeson County in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. So I approach these problems from a very close point. But I have a home, and my people are tobacco workers and sharecroppers today on plantations in that county. But a part of that soil belongs to me. That's my roots. These are my roots in this country. On the other hand, also, I felt that... somewhere, the contributions that I had... could make some contribution from my background traveling about the world. However, I never expected, I am quite willing to say, that I would be restricted from traveling.
Yes.
Well, tell me, Mr. Robeson, was your commitment to the political scene then largely as a result of your feeling about your own people, or our own people, let's put it?
Yeah.
Or did it have other overtones of political conviction?
First it starts as an American Negro interested in my own people. The other great change is very constant in my mind. I was in the Welsh Valley, and the Welsh people sing very much like we do in the Negro people.
Yes, I've heard
many
them.
Of our songs, beautiful songs. And I was one of the few outsiders who has sung at a Welsh Eisteddfod, their national festival, which has gone on since the time of the Druids. And I went down in the mines with the workers, and they explained to me that, Paul, you may be successful here in England, but your people suffer like ours. We are poor people. And you belong to us. You don't belong to the bigwigs here in this country. And so I today feel as much at home in the Welsh Valley as I would in my own Negro section, any city in the United States. And I just did a broadcast by translated cable to the Welsh Valley a few weeks ago. And here was the first understanding that the struggle of the Negro people, or of any people, cannot be by itself. That is, the human struggle. And so I was attracted then met many members of the Labour Party, and my politics embraced also the common struggle of all oppressed peoples, including especially the working masses, specifically the laboring people of all the world. And that defines my philosophy. It's a joining one of we are a working people, a laboring people, the Negro people. And there is a unity between our struggle and those of white workers. In the South, I've had white workers shake my hand and say, Paul, we are fighting for the same thing. And so this defines my attitude towards socialism and toward many other things in the world. I do not believe that a few people should control the wealth of any land, that it should be a collective ownership in the interest of all.
Is that a democratic socialism, or...?
I would have to be a democratic socialism. There are many ways, however, to struggle toward democracy, as I see that in a place like China, for example, today, the Soviet Union, many other places, or take our own problems of Negroes. If we were free in the South tomorrow, to carry our weight, to vote into everything. Well, do we now look around and try to find the 10 billionaires among our people? Would we attempt to build them up, or would we try to answer the needs of the great millions of our people? And so I see other ways of life, socialism, as trying to solve the problems of millions and tens of millions of peoples at once, in a way, instead of we would start from the individual to the masses, they start from the masses this way. Now, there are two ways, and there are difficulties each way. I have made the decision to join in a collective struggle, and the reason that my personal sacrifices mean very little in the struggle, in one way, when you see the children at Little Rock, what does not giving a few concerts mean, if you can make some other contribution? It's in that context. So nothing is perfect in the world. We're going toward it from different angles. I feel there's a great burden of proof on every society, on our own as well, today.
Mr. Robeson, some years ago, I was talking to a French member of the Communist Party.
Yes.
And in the course of our discussion, he said to me, you, Mr. Winkler, are a Jeffersonian Democrat.
Yes.
You can afford it in your rich land.
Yes.
But in my land and in other lands, we must give up our freedom now to certain men in order to achieve freedom for our children in the future. This is an act of faith for me, he said, giving up my freedom now. Do you find yourself sympathetic with
I don't think that is, I would put it quite differently. No, nor do I think that's any part of any socialist philosophy or communist philosophy, as far as I know, that we struck it during the war under Roosevelt, for example. We had to give up many privileges. They're practically telling us we have to do that again. I mean, in any sort of a war economy, in England, for example, they have not eaten eggs almost for years and years because of certain pressures. And it seems to me in the socialist lands, the Soviet Union, China, and many places, that that's quite true. It's one thing to say today that they don't have as shining apparel as we do, but they have made tremendous scientific progress. And within a one generation, so to speak, within 40 years, have become one of the most powerful countries in the world. Now, they've done it by great sacrifices, and not by, to my mind, they feel that the country, in one sense, the man in the street, may not in every essence belong to him, but he feels it's much more his than, say, I do in Charleston, South Carolina, when one Southern American Negro explained to me that I was in the state of our great plantations. I said, are you sure about that? Our great plantations. I don't feel that they're my plantations. But in one sense, some of the people in socialist lands feel that the country does belong to them in a real sense. Now, there are, as far as the basic concept of the dictatorship of the proletariat and so forth, isn't it? I would say, again, bring it back to our own history. There was, as we know, a dictatorship of the North over the South in the days following the Civil War. When that dictatorship was removed, the colored people reverted practically into a kind of servitude. I could have conceived of a dictatorship over the South for quite a longer period, from my point of view, quite frankly. So this is understandable.
Yes. In your book, Mr. Robeson, Here I Stand, you have a chapter entitled The Power of Negro Action.
That's right.
What are some of the specific acts which you recommend, and perhaps in the order of priority?
Yeah. Well, I say in any Negro life, you would say that nobody, this is, seems to be rather startling to many of my friends, nobody would be startled, say, with taking the vote, the power of Italian action, or Polish action in Detroit, or Catholic action in New York, and so forth. I mean, that the vote would be a block, and the power of the Negro vote in the North in certain states. This is one very important aspect. Very clear. A kind of... we have tremendous economic power in this land today. There should be tremendous support of Negro business, of Negro banks, and so forth, and loan associations, and so forth. But the prime thing is that I'm convinced that... Yes,
Taking this last illustration of yours, have you not found that as Negro bankers become richer, that they grow away from your people?
No, I don't.
Do they remain a part of total Negro action?
There's no way for, as I said before, for any American Negro, however wealthy, however famous, to be anything at this period of our history at some point than an American Negro. If he doesn't know it, he'll find it out.
From a racial standpoint, yeah, Mr. Robeson, yeah. But from the political standpoint of socialism, which you were discussing a few moments ago, surely a Negro capitalist, if he had the opportunity, would undoubtedly behave according to the lights of his own...
He has to, but I know many of the most wealthy, and they often I feel that they don't help as much as they should. But he's forever conscious his children suffer the same things as the poor Negro's children. And at some point, he finds a way to help. Mm-hmm. It's a little different even there. But that is... What I'm trying to say is that somewhere for our own dignity, I see, that is Africa, would you understand, Ghana today, unifying as with its own... sort of, you know, nationalist strength. Is that clear?
Yes. Yeah.
I feel in America, strange to say, especially in the South, that even with all the goodwill of white liberals in the country, that it's very important for the Negro people to know what they want and to unify to do it. Often in a very simple case of fighting segregation, one group of Negroes can be drawn aside because of political pressure, other pressures. We should unify too. We should unify.
Yes.
I feel there's got to be a unity in order to integrate. That's what I feel. But I feel that we just can't integrate as individuals.
Yes. But isn't the example of Liberia, for example, a sorry example, as it's set against Ghana?
Well, yes, because that's a very simple. The Firestone has taken care of that. It has been exploited to its hilt by Firestone rubber, if you don't know the facts.
Yes, right. It still remains, then,
right.
an economic
and
question.
And so has Ghana.
Rather than a racial unity question. It remains an economic question
no,
in
no.
its fundamentals
no,
rather
I think
than the
that
unity
Ghana
of the
also,
Negro people.
Ghana has the unity of its own nation, same as Chinese or Indians, very close to India. India's just, they have a culture and a history that has its own national characteristics.
But what will prevent Ghana from becoming another Liberia?
That's the...
What do you mean?
Well, from because
Liberia
of the
today
pressures.
Is completely controlled by Firestone, not by Africans. But I feel that Nkrumah is going to control the economy of Ghana, and at some time be strong enough to say to the European, either you sit here and acknowledge that we run our own country, like Nehru, or else you go. But I don't see the day when Liberia can tell Firestone to do that. Oh, they're quite different. They're quite different. Liberia is a complete vassal state of American capital, finance capital, without question. They have nothing to say, nothing whatsoever.
What is your reaction to the passive resistance as practiced in Montgomery?
Well, I think there was a magnificent movement, and nobody can, I say, there's nothing, as far as the general thing of a nonviolent solution of the problem, this is the, there could be no other solution within our, within the frame of things today. I mean, this is a very important contribution. Nobody could think of a violent solution unless somebody wanted to ask somebody to be destroyed. I mean, that would be absurd. On the other hand, within that framework, I think that the Negro people have to be extremely militant and demand a little more than they are demanding today, and to do a little more, to do other things as well as pray. Let me put it, as well as pray.
Do you think there's been a change in the attitude of the Negro churches toward militant political and economic action, Mr. Rhodes?
I think there has, because it's history, you know. Take Frederick Douglass. I belong to the AME Zion Church. There is one in this area. And Douglass was a part of that church. Harriet Tubman, who formed the Underground Railroad, who was called the Moses of our people. They sang Go Down Moses when she came into the South to free the slaves. And Harriet Tubman. And we have a tradition of tremendous... consistent speaking out, you know, for our rights, like in the whole civil rights struggle. I mean by militant, letting people know that you want to be free like anybody else. And I think the churches, however, a lot of the responsibility still rests upon our churches, because that's where so many of our people, you know, go. They have tremendous influence still.
Mr. Robeson, do you think your artistry as a singer and actor have suffered because of your involvement in political action are profited?
They have not. I feel that they have profited. They've only suffered when they've suffered by the fact that because of my political views, which I certainly did not expect in a democracy, that I've been prevented from exercising my craft. However, I've kept singing all through the years. You may be able to test it pretty soon. I just made a recording the other day for Vanguard, which they felt was superior to any records I have ever made. My voice is still in fine shape. I've been in the area. And as far as Othello, I've worked on it. I feel I've just been invited to play at Stratford-on-Avon, the Shakespeare Memorial Theatre in England, in Pericles, to play the part of Gower. And I would certainly do Othello at some point in London, and I feel I would give a better performance. I feel that in every, and I've got a lot of things here which we won't be able to get to in my music, comparing the folk music of the world, I would say that my interest in my art has deepened just no end in the last years, and I've become interested in the music of Bartok, of Mussorgsky, many folk things, the unity of the folk music of the world, which has sprung from my political conviction that all people should be unified. I have seen it expressed in their music, and I do a program which of all the songs of all the peoples in the world, suggesting that we are all one human family. It all comes to that. So I feel that basically that it has deepened my. On the other hand, I have never separated my work as an artist from my work as a human being. I've always put it even more strongly that, to me, my art is always a weapon. It's got to be good art. Othello was a weapon in racial relations, or at least showing that we can do some things too. I played football My father explained to me that, well, a fella hit me, I couldn't hit him back because they'd say we were bad and savage. So I had to stand and be knocked all around. I had to do well in my studies. So I've never been able to divorce one thing from the other. And luckily, I don't sing the kind of songs that may, you're here and you hit the high, whatever it is, the high B flat and the high this and the high that. I sing songs that express very much the emotions of different peoples, like the Welsh, the Scots, the Negro, Chinese, Russian, and so forth.
Well, what is the present state of play on this passport business? You were talking about your British invitations.
Yes.
How are you going to get there?
Well, luckily, I think at this point, the basic case is before the Supreme Court. It's the case of Rockwell Kent, contending that all the cases revolve around, that when the State Department put in its administrative necessities that one sign a non-communist affidavit, whether or not he is, was, or so forth, that this is a violation of constitutional rights. Any American now has to sign this, this particular proposal. And this is before the Supreme Court. And in its present temper, it seems to me that the court might easily decide.
And this is what you refuse to do. You refuse to sign such a document.
Oh, yeah, completely refuse. This is a complete invitation. Did you murder your wife yesterday or the day before? Are you a Republican? Are you a Democrat? This is but my political opinions are my own business, you know. This is a complete, and I say we have the background of the reversal in the Smith Act cases all over this country. So somebody was framed, I would say. So it shows that all of it, to my mind, is a complete hoax from somewhere.
In other words, you're hoping that on the basis of some of the current court decisions that you may get your passport in time to go to
Yes, or I have now been invited to sing on April 6th in a national television broadcast. Maybe I could get special permission to go. I mean, and because of my background in England, there is almost a national, almost demand from England or request that I be allowed to come in April and even before the summer. And also I take some optimistic point of view from the fact that where no passports are needed, after restricting me for many years, even in that area, this had to be lifted because the courts would certainly, I think, have ruled that this was completely illegal once I was stopped from going to Hawaii, Puerto Rico, which are parts of the United States. So I can now go anywhere in this hemisphere.
Oh, you're not dangerous as long as you stick to the Western Hemisphere?
I'm just saying, if a court is looking at this, how can the State Department argue that if I leave the country, this is extremely dangerous, the guy, he got up in court, the fellow, and if I left, it was going to be a catastrophe. I don't know what would happen the next morning, immediately I got on the plane. But I can now be in Brazil, I can be in the West Indies, I can be in Canada, I can be anywhere in this hemisphere. Why can't I be in London? It doesn't make any sense to me. Mm-hmm. So I'm optimistic that I may get my passport.
Mr. Rosen, however, if we may change
direction. Yes, I'd like to
direction.
Get to my concert.
could I, however, ask you some questions along another line for a moment? I have three small children of my own, and I'm very much interested in the problems of children with relation to these larger problems of a man standing up for certain things. Have your children moved around the world with you? In the course of your travels?
Well, I just have one boy.
Oh, you just have one boy.
Just one boy. And he, as you know, traveled around from the time he was about two, traveled with me everywhere, and lived in England and went to school for a part of his youth in the Soviet Union, speaks Russian very well. And he is now in this country, went to Cornell, and he has two beautiful grandchildren. And he is very happy. His was a mixed marriage in one sense. He married a very wonderful Jewish girl of a Romanian Jewish background, and they're extremely happy. Have two
this
children.
This is concentrating all the problems.
All the problems. And they are very happy and get along very well in Harlem where they live in the Negro community. They are both, may I say, to use a much abused term, progressive young Americans. and he's an electronics engineer and a very fine acoustical engineer. We've done some work together. And she teaches in school, teaches children. There are two children in school, so she teaches in young children in school. And they're very happy. And my wife is an accredited correspondent at the United Nations and does a lot of work for different publications throughout the world. So we keep pretty busy. But I am very happy to get to the core, be back at my singing, and to say that however I have talk this afternoon that I have great faith. I wouldn't be here if I did not have great faith in our, that somewhere we will realize the democratic potentials of our life, of our society. I deeply believe that. I fight for peace. I feel we've got to live with many other kinds of systems and other beliefs in the world. We've been able to do it through many generations and centuries. That's the reason why we couldn't find peace in that destruction. And a little faster in understanding the problems of oppressed peoples, wherever they may be. But very happy to be back in the area to sing. In fact, I've come back here, you know, sung in the Negro churches at the Third Baptist in San Francisco, and I sang in Oakland, and I sang in Sacramento and Stockton, and I've been back at my career now for quite some time, mainly in the Negro churches.
Has this been a change? I was not aware that you had been singing in the Negro churches
yes.
up until recently.
Yes. I wasn't able to sing anywhere else. I wasn't able to get the auditoriums. On the other hand, we have a great tradition in Negro life. All of us, Marian Anderson, Hayes, we all began in Negro churches. And my brother is pastor of a very large church in New York. And every Sunday afternoon, you may go there and hear any of the top Negro artists in the whole concert field, Warfield, anybody. We always go back to the churches. And so it's been a very fine way to walk into a church full of about 2,000 people and say, well, Paul's here this morning, and it's just to see how he sounds. It comes out very well. Why fine? But I really have begun and been practicing, and my whole, I mean, have come back into the swing of things in this area. And I want to say that I go so far as to say in this period, some people have said no, but I have found the Pacific Coast, especially the Bay Area, vastly different. I found it very different in feeling from some other sections of the United States. Other people have felt this. Many outside people who come here to United Nations gatherings feel that you are a little more non-hysterical, that you have a little evidently deeper belief in our democratic faith. And I have felt that. I felt that, so much so that I may even come out to sit around for quite a while.
Well, we think it's a wonderful city.
Where may we hear you sing in the near future?
Well, you're going to hear me, I hope, on Sunday afternoon, February 9th, at the Oakland Auditorium Theater. It'd be very important. It's the first time I've had a public auditorium in the area for quite some time. It's sponsored by a committee, a Negro Life, and honoring Negro History Week, which, you know, has been honored now for some time, and Mr. William Duncan Allen, a very gifted pianist who is accompanying me and who is chairman of the Bach Festival in the Berkeley area, is playing some compositions of leading Negro composers. It's an afternoon of music and poetry. I'm reciting some Shakespeare and some Negro and poetry from Negro poets, and singing, as I say, music that ranges through all the folk music of the world. And those composers like Bartok and Mussorgsky and Dvorak, who have used the folk idiom in their extended and more complex works.
It sounds as if it will be a delightful afternoon.
Well, I hope so.
And we are very grateful to you for coming along to KPFA.
I'm grateful
Good
to you.
Mr. Robson.
Thank you, Mr. Robson.
Welcome back. And that was an interview from 1958 with Paul Robeson, and we're paying tribute to Paul Robeson on his 126th birthday, and that was recorded in 1958. His son, who he referenced in the interview, Paul Robeson Jr., we're going to go to him to listen to a report on the level of U.S. repression and how it impacted Paul Robeson.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. I'd like to try to put my father's persecution in a context to show the continuity between then and now. I can speak with some authority because I've also been a target of both COINTELPRO and MKUltra. Been more fortunate than most. I'm still here and healthy. Most people who have had that experience are no longer with us. In terms of a context, the people who did that to my father and to me are part of what I call the permanent government. They have been here since before the Civil War. they were responsible for the assassination of Lincoln, of Kennedy, and many, many more. They have been responsible for starting wars, for covert operations that have tried to start wars. They have been involved in assassinations of foreign diplomats and heads of state, and on and on and on. Contrary to the mythology, the most important part of that secret government is run out of a secret operation in the Defense Department, out of Defense Intelligence, which gets 80% of the budget. That's where the ball game is. That's why the 9/11 Commission focused on a czar who would extract the budget and control from the Defense Department. The CIA is small stuff. However, they're coordinated, and the real dirty work is done by something called the Field Operations Unit of Military Intelligence. Now, those people are around because they come from a special segment of the American population since before the Civil War. They belong to a specific ethnic group and a regional group. They are part of an elite in this country that used to call itself the WASP ascendancy. The ethnic designation is English and German, otherwise known as Anglo-Saxon. They used to call themselves WASPs, but that's no longer in vogue. They have a predominantly southern center of gravity, wealthy, and fundamentalist Protestant. WASP stands for White Anglo-Saxon Protestant. Since Anglo-Saxons are already white, that's double white Protestant, meaning super white. They are the cousins, if not the brothers, in constituency and culture of Hitler's Nazis out of southern Germany, specifically. Down around Bavaria and Austria is where Hitler came from. That's the core of the Nazi tradition. And the cultures and outlooks of the tradition of Hitler in Germany and the Confederacy in the United States are almost identical. And if you read Mein Kampf, you will read Hitler's compliments to, you know, if the Americans get their stuff together and go Confederate-wise, they'll be just like us. Now, that's hidden, and nobody talks about ethnicity in this country for that very reason. They were the core of the slave owners. And let's say I have a special bias against them because I happen to be the grandson of not just a slave, but a field slave. And that's some difference between a freedman and a house slave and a skilled slave. So that struggle has been going on for generations. And America has always been two, not one. That's what John Edwards is talking about. Two Americas. One America is simply enough, the tradition of the Confederacy. The other is the tradition of the Union. Now, both of them are led by WASP, one Lincoln and one Jefferson Davis. Difference night and day. The progressive America is Lincoln, Roosevelt, Kennedy. The reactionary America is Jefferson Davis, Ronald Reagan, and Bush 1 and 2, especially 2. Anglo-Saxon, okay, Southern, in Bush's case sort of transferred from north to south, but southern core, fundamentalist Protestant, and wealthy. Slave owners updated, and what you're looking at is something like a neo-Confederacy. That's what's going on. Now, my father, the son of a field slave, fought that America to the death from day one. And well, I try to continue with that tradition. That is the enemy. Capital E. either one America or the other will triumph in the end. That's what the Civil War is about, and it's still going on. This crisis is similar to the Civil War and other crises between the two Americas, and it's choose-up time. That's what is happening. Now, my father was point man for the progressive America. Anti-war, opposed three of them. Cold War, Korean War, Vietnam War. He's talking about, I'm looking for freedom, full freedom, now, not an inferior bread. Either or. There's no such thing as half free. And secondly, to add to culture and race, the issue of class. Yeah, I'm for the meek inherit the earth means they take it. Mm-hmm. And right now, class is big time, in case you hadn't noticed, although you can't say that. You say working families, but don't you dare say working class, or you can't get elected dog catcher because you're some kind of socialist, communist, or whatever. However, this country is two Americas, 80% below $75,000 a year and 20% above $75,000 a year. Well, that's the issue. The country's now run for the top 20%, actually the top 10 or so, 15, blacks included, and another 80% later for them. Well, the 80% time has come, and that's a big issue among black folks. So you're talking about class, race, and culture all together. You can't leave any of them out. And the fourth leg of the chair is peace. Because if you got some liberals running around, well, they're Cold War liberals. Well, we'll do guns and butter. We got to fight either communism or terrorism or whatever abroad and establish some kind of empire. They're going to deep six everything progressive. No, you can't have progressive domestic policy and a warlike or imperial foreign policy and have a decent anything at home. And you don't believe it, look what Truman did with his, he started the Cold War, and Johnson, the war on poverty, turned out to be a kind of a half measure. Because black folks, minorities, poor folks were not in power. It was against that background that for centuries they've gone after the progressives. And by progressives, I mean, let's say Tom Paine, who said against slavery, et cetera, et cetera. Now, Jefferson's a slave owner, so that's a big difference. So read Tom Paine and then read the Declaration of Independence, and you'll see the difference. So my father, 40, 50 years ago, is way out on the progressive side, point man. So he was lucky to survive at all. Now, they began going after him under COINTELPRO, that's the FBI, under a progressive president, Roosevelt, who even with all his power couldn't get rid of Hoover. Hoover more or less did what he wanted, law or no law. So he started going after Dad when he was at the height of his popularity, 1940s. Ballot for Americans, Bard of Liberty, Herald of Freedom, Othello, All-American, I mean, he was everything. They called him America's number one Negro, whatever that's worth. In any case, guest at the White House, all this. Hoover busy not only surveillance, but bugged his apartment, bugged his phone, on and on, followed him around, etc. This is 1940s. Come 1946, there's the Cold War, and Dad has nerve enough to go down to Washington, D.C., by the way, co-chairman of the campaign for crusade against lynching was Albert Einstein, no less. So they go down to ask Truman to end lynching. Oh, no, Truman said, I can't do that because it's a political issue, the time isn't right, and so on. Well, Dad's saying it's a moral issue. And by the way, Mr. President, I must say, if the federal government can't protect black folks in the South, maybe veterans down there will have to defend themselves. Then you'll have to send federal troops there. So Truman jumps up, shakes his finger. That sounds like a threat. He's all red in the face. And Dad, all 6 feet 3, 240 pounds, still athletic, slowly gets up from his seat. And the Secret Service men on either side of the president's desk, they jump out to the side of the desk, open up the jacket, showing the 45. And they're just standing there. And somebody in the delegation there said, well, we meant no threat to the president. And Dad said, of course not. I meant no disrespect to the office of the presidency. I just was expressing how black folks, who are 10% of the population, feel. So Truman sputters, okay, this meeting's over. So this is headline. Robeson and Truman go at it. And from the Freedom of Information Act documents I got, is right after that meeting, President Truman calls in General Vaughn, who's his military aide, and says, this Robeson fella, he's getting to be kind of a problem. Why don't you tell J. Edgar Hoover to kind of keep tabs on it? Now that means Hoover has license to help the president solve his problem. And we know what that is. Well, by some coincidence, this is 46, right after that, that's called by the House Un-American Activities Committee. He tells them to go, well, I won't quote it, but he was a lawyer, so he wound them around his finger. But in the meantime, suddenly he's picketing. After a concert, he picketed a segregated movie theater in St. Louis, and on the way to another town with a friend of his, the left front wheel of the car comes off on the highway. Well, fortunately, they weren't going too fast, and nothing happened. But if you're going fast and the left wheel comes off, you swerve into the oncoming traffic. You're very dead. And that happens to be a signature of the FBI. Their hits are by retired FBI people who, some of whom, they have this way, you sabotage, oh, it's easy to sabotage the wheel. You loosen up the things so that the wheel comes off when the speed comes up. And then in the 1950s, there were two more such incidents. Of course, that's no longer under Truman, that's under Eisenhower, who's a liberal Republican. Well, if you recall, he says, watch out for the military-industrial complex. He's talking about these people, whom he can't control. Okay, so flash forward to Kennedy. He's the first Irish Catholic ever to be president, and he's talking about, if you read his inaugural address carefully, he's talking about peace. Say the real enemy is disease, poverty, and war itself. So he's talking about ending the Cold War. And on top of that, he says there's a line in which he says, a free nation that cannot protect its rich, that cannot help its poor, cannot save its rich. Well, that was his death warrant. I mean, especially Irish Catholic can't do that. Okay. So this is the people that did the following to my father. It's MK Ultra now, because COINTELPRO didn't work. That was all kinds of psychological warfare and so on. That just didn't work. They tried to discredit him by spreading lies about him, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't go into the details of that. That's going to be in my second volume. But they decided they needed to do, let's say, a little more effective neutralization measures. So there's a program called MK Ultra, where the CIA developed under Helms and Alan Dulles a program for using a special drug, later known as LSD, hallucinogenic drug, which if you drop a little and give somebody a Mickey Finn with that, the reaction, chemical reaction, is such that extreme depression. And people get so depressed and frightened and whatnot, they usually commit suicide. And then, of course, they have a depression. Terrible, you know. Well, there was an incident in 1961. My father was abroad. He'd gotten his passport, couldn't travel to China and elsewhere, like Cuba and China and a couple of other countries. He had never been to Africa. He wanted to go there. So he, since he's under surveillance in London, decided, well, he'd been abroad 4 or 5 years, time to go home, join the civil rights movement, so he's going to violate the passport regulations, go to Africa and then China. And on the way back, Fidel Castro had invited him to drop in at Havana, so he decided he'd do that. The problem was he couldn't do that from London too well, because not only the CIA and military intelligence, but London's the British MI6 is something like these American people. That's under Tony Blair these days. He's brought them back big time, even though he's a Labour person. But in any case, Dad wisely says, well, I'll go to Moscow and take off from there. Problem was that it was a few weeks before the Bay of Pigs. So these characters thinking, well, if we hit the beaches and Robeson's sitting in Havana with Castro, it's not too good. So since Robeson's in Moscow anyway, what better place to take him out than in Moscow? Then Egg will be on the face of the KGB besides. Nobody will believe that. So essentially that's what happened. There was a party in his quarters, and somebody gave him a Mickey Finn. He slashed his wrist, but not somehow he didn't do it enough. They caught him early, and by the time my mother and I got there, he was fine. I mean, not fine, but he was in pretty good shape. He recovered, and the Soviet doctors wisely said the best place for him is at home in Harlem among his own people, because, strangely enough, they won't hit him there. If he's wandering around abroad, he's asking for it. So Dad, I got 3 minutes, so I'll wind up. Dad made the mistake of going back to London to pick up his things. And I made the mistake of, on my own, because I was young and stupid then, decided I'm going to investigate on my own what happened to Dad, which they warned me is strange times, don't do that. Oh, I'm big in bed. Anyway, something similar happened to me, but I was fortunate I walked away from it. But then I couldn't take him home, so they hit him in London again, and he wound up in a London psychiatric hospital, where, under a program which is an extension of MKUltra, their MI6 British colleagues arranged for him to get 54 electroshock treatments in a hurry. That's enough to knock out an elephant, but he still had enough left to really make a pretty good recovery when he came home, was starting to get back into public life when he got hit again. And that was enough not to knock him out entirely. But that was his retirement. He decided, well, he was not going to be in public in that shape. Let him remember me the way I am. And he suffered for, well, maybe 15 years in that shape and gritted his teeth, never complained. Well, his legacy is important because the same people are around now doing the same tricks from 9/11 to New Orleans. That's why the folks are staying there, because the idea is the way you get rid of the poor, especially in the ghetto, is called ghetto removal. That's what's going on. So it is choose-up time, and my time is up, so we'll leave the rest of the question period. But I would say what happened then is happening now in a different guise, and what we need is to decide and make clear who the enemy is and fight them like we did in the Civil War in the 1930s and in the 1960s. This time, let's pick up where Martin left off, Memphis and the Poor People's Campaign this time. And among our own folks, it's time to choose up who's going to bell the cat and who isn't, and especially who serves the enemy. We should not allow our folks to do that politically.
Welcome back. That was Paul Robeson Jr. Discussing repression from the United States and how it impacted his father, Paul Robeson Sr. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast for Sunday, April the 7th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. And just 60 years ago, this coming week, it will represent the delivery of the ballot or bullet speech by Malcolm X in Detroit on April 12th of 1964. We want to review that speech at this time.
Mr. Moderator, Reverend Klieg, brothers and sisters, and friends, and I see some enemies. In fact, I think we'd be fooling ourselves if we had an audience this large and didn't realize that there were some enemies present. This afternoon, we want to talk about the ballot or the bullet. The ballot or the bullet explains itself. But before we get into it, since this is the year of the ballot or the bullet, I would like to clarify some things that refer to me personally concerning my own personal position. I'm still a Muslim. That is, my religion is still Islam. My religion is still Islam. I still credit Mr. Muhammad for what I know and what I am. He's the one who opened my eyes. And at present, I'm the minister of the newly founded Muslim Mosque Incorporated, which has its offices in the Teresa Hotel right in the heart of Harlem. That's the Black Belt in New York City. And when we realize that Adam Clayton Powell is a Christian minister, he has Abyssinia Baptist Church, but at the same time, he's more famous for his political struggling. And Dr. King is a Christian minister in Atlanta, Georgia, but he's become more famous for being involved in the civil rights struggle. There's another in New York, Reverend Galamison. I don't know if you've heard of him out here. He's a Christian minister from Brooklyn, but has become famous for his fight against the segregated school system in Brooklyn. Reverend Klieg, right here, is a Christian minister here in Detroit. He's the head of the Freedom Now Party. All of these are Christian ministers. All of these are Christian ministers, but they don't come to us as Christian ministers. They come to us as fighters in some other category. I'm a Muslim minister. The same as they are Christian ministers, I'm a Muslim minister. And I don't believe in fighting today in any one front, but on all fronts. In fact, I'm a black nationalist freedom fighter. Islam is my religion, but I believe my religion is my personal business. It governs my personal life, my personal morals. And my religious philosophy is personal between me and the God in whom I believe, just as the religious philosophy of these others is between them and the God in whom they believe. And this is best this way. Were we to come out here discussing religion, we'd have too many differences from the outstart, and we could never get together. So today, though Islam is my religious philosophy, my political, economic, and social philosophy is black nationalism. You and I, As I say, if we bring up religion, we'll have differences, we'll have arguments, we'll never be able to get together. But if we keep our religion at home, keep our religion in the closet, keep our religion between ourselves and our God, but when we come out here, we have a fight that's common to all of us against the enemy who is common to all of us. The political philosophy of black nationalism only means that the black man should control the politics and the politicians in his own community. The time when white people can come in our community and get us to vote for them so that they can be our political leaders and tell us what to do and what not to do is long gone. By the same token, the time when that same white man, knowing that your eyes are too far open, can send another Negro into the community, get you and me to support him so he can use him to lead us astray, those days are long gone. The political philosophy of black nationalism only means that if you and I are going to live in a black community, and that's where we're going to live, because as soon as you move into one of their, soon as you move out of the black community into their community, it's missed for a period of time, but they're gone, and you're right there all by yourself. We must understand the politics of our community, and we must know what politics is supposed to produce. We must know what politics play in our lives. And until we become politically mature, we will always be misled, led astray, or deceived, or maneuvered into supporting someone politically who doesn't have the good of our community at heart. So the political philosophy of black nationalism only means that we will have to carry on a program, a political program of re-education, to open our people's eyes, make us become more politically conscious, politically mature. And then we will, whenever we get ready to cast our ballot, that ballot will be cast for a man of the community who has the good of the community at heart. And the economic philosophy of black nationalism only means that we should own and operate and control the economy of our community. You would never find, you can't open up a black store in a white community. White man won't even patronize you. And he's not wrong. He got sense enough to look out for himself. And you who don't have sense enough to look out for yourself. The white man is too intelligent to let someone else come and gain control of the economy of his community. But you will let anybody come in and control the economy of your community. Control the housing, control the education, control the jobs, control the businesses under the pretext that you want to integrate. No, you're out of your mind. The economic philosophy of black nationalism only means that we have to become involved in a program of re-education to educate our people into the importance of knowing that when you spend your dollar out of the community in which you live, the community in which you spend your money becomes richer and richer. The community out of which you take your money becomes poorer and poorer. And because these Negroes who have been misled, misguided, are breaking their necks to take their money and spend it with the man. The man is becoming richer and richer, and you're becoming poorer and poorer. And then what happens? The community in which you live becomes a slum. It becomes a ghetto. The conditions become run down. And then you have the audacity to complain about poor housing in a run-down community. Why, you run it down yourself when you take your dollar out. And you and I are in a double trap because
Not only do we lose by taking our money someplace else and spending it, when we try and spend it in our own community, we're trapped because we haven't had sense enough to set up stores and control the businesses of our community. The man who's controlling the stores in our community is a man who doesn't look like we do. He's a man who doesn't even live in the community. So you and I, even when we try and spend our money in the block where we live or the area where we live, we're spending it with a man who, when the sun goes down, takes that basket full of money in another part of the town. So we're trapped, double trapped, triple trapped. Anywhere we go, we find that we're trapped. And every kind of solution that someone comes up with is just another trap. But the political and economic philosophy of black nationalism, the economic philosophy of black nationalism shows our people the importance of setting up these little stores and developing them and expanding them into larger operations. Woolworth didn't start out big like they are today. They started out with a dime store and expanded and expanded and expanded until today they're all over the country and all over the world, and they're getting some of everybody's money. Now, this is what you and I and General Motors, the same way, didn't start out like it is. It started out just a little rat race type operation, and it expanded and expanded until today is where it is right now. And you and I have to make a start. And the best place to start is right in the community where we live. So our people not only have to be re-educated to the importance of supporting black business, but the black man himself has to be made aware of the importance of going into business. And once you and I go into business, we own and operate at least the businesses in our community. What we will be doing is developing a situation wherein we will actually be able to create employment for the people in the community. And once you can create some employment in the community where you live, it will eliminate the necessity of you and me having to act ignorantly and disgracefully boycotting and picketing some cracker someplace else trying to bang him for a job. Anytime you have to rely upon your enemy for a job, you're in bad shape. And he is your enemy. Anytime, you wouldn't be in this country if some enemy hadn't kidnapped you and brought you here. On the other hand, some of you think you came here on the Mayflower. So as you can see, brothers and sisters, today, this afternoon, it's not our intention to discuss religion. We're going to forget religion. If we bring up religion, we'll be in an argument. And the best way to keep away from arguments and differences, as I said earlier, put your religion at home, in the closet. Keep it between you and your God. Because if it hasn't done anything more for you than it has, you need to forget it anyway. Whether you are a Christian or a Muslim or a nationalist, we all have the same problem. They don't hang you because you're a Baptist. They hang you because you're black. They don't attack me because I'm a Muslim. They attack me because I'm black. They attack all of us for the same reason. All of us catch hell from the same enemy. We're all in the same bag, in the same boat. We suffer political oppression, economic exploitation, and social degradation. All of them from the same enemy. The government has failed us. You can't deny that. Anytime you live in the 20th century, 1964, and you walking around here singing, "We shall overcome," the government has failed us. This is part of what's wrong with you. You do too much singing. Today it's time to stop singing and start swinging. You can't sing up on freedom, but you can swing up on some freedom. Cassius Clay can sing, but singing didn't help him to become the heavyweight champion of the world. Swinging helped him. So this government has failed us. The government itself has failed us. And the white liberals, who have been posing as our friends, have failed us. And once we see that all these other sources to which we turn have failed, we stop turning to them and turn to ourselves. We need a self-help program, a do-it-yourself philosophy, a do-it-right-now philosophy, it's-already-too-late philosophy. This is what you and I need to get with. And the only way we're going to solve our problem is with a self-help program. Before we can get a self-help program started, we have to have a self-help philosophy. Black nationalism is a self-help philosophy. What's so good about it, you can stay right in the church where you are and still take black nationalism as your philosophy. You can stay in any kind of civic organization that you belong to and still take black nationalism as your philosophy. You can be an atheist and still take black nationalism as your philosophy. This is a philosophy that eliminates the necessity for division and argument. Because if you're black, you should be thinking black. And if you're black and you're not thinking black at this late date, well, I'm sorry for you. Once you change your philosophy, you change your thought pattern. Once you change your thought pattern, you change your attitude. Once you change your attitude, it changes your behavior pattern. And then you go on into some action. As long as you got a sit-down philosophy, you'll have a sit-down thought pattern. And as long as you think that old sit-down thought, you'll be in some kind of sit-down action. They'll have you sitting in everywhere. It's not so good to refer to what you're going to do as a sit-in. That right there castrates you. Right there it brings you down. What goes with it? What, think of the image of someone sitting. An old woman can sit. An old man can sit. A chump can sit. A coward can sit. Anything can sit. Well, you and I have been sitting long enough, and it's time today for us to start doing some standing and some fighting to back that up. When we look at other parts of this earth upon which we live, we find that black, brown, red, and yellow people in Africa and Asia are getting their independence. They're not getting it by singing, "We shall overcome." No, they're getting it through nationalism. It is nationalism that brought about the independence of the people in Asia. Every nation in Asia gained its independence through the philosophy of nationalism. Every nation on the African continent that has gotten its independence brought it about through the philosophy of nationalism. And it will take black nationalism that to bring about the freedom of 22 million Afro-Americans here in this country where we have suffered colonialism for the past 400 years. America is just as much a colonial power as England ever was. America is just as much a colonial power as France ever was. In fact, America is more so a colonial power than they, because she's a hypocritical colonial power behind it. What do you call second-class citizenship? Why, that's colonization. Second-class citizenship is nothing but 20th century slavery. How are you going to tell me you're a second-class citizen? They don't have second-class citizenship in any other government on this earth. They just have slaves and people who are free. Well, this country is a hypocrite. They try and make you think they set you free by calling you a second-class citizen. No, you're nothing but a 20th century slave. Just as it took nationalism to move, to remove colonialism from Asia and Africa. It'll take black nationalism today to remove colonialism from the backs and the minds of 22 million Afro-Americans here in this country. And 1964 looks like it might be the year of the ballot or the bullet. Why does it look like it might be the year of the ballot or the bullet? Because Negroes have listened to the trickery and the lies and the false promises of the white man now for too long. And they're fed up. They've become disenchanted. They've become disillusioned. They've become dissatisfied. And all of this has built up frustrations in the black community that makes the black community throughout America today more explosive than all of the atomic bombs the Russians can ever invent. Whenever you got a racial powder keg sitting in your lap, you're in more trouble than if you had an atomic powder keg sitting in your lap. When a racial powder keg goes off, it doesn't care who it knocks out the way. Understand this, it's dangerous. And in 1964, this seems to be the year. Because what can the white man use now to fool us? After he put down that march on Washington, and you see all through that now, he tricked you, had you marching down to Washington. Yes, had you marching back and forth between the feet of a dead man named Lincoln and another dead man named George Washington, singing, "We Shall Overcome." He made a chump out of you. He made a fool out of you. He made you think you were going somewhere and you end up going nowhere but between Lincoln and Washington. So today our people are disillusioned. They've become disenchanted. They've become dissatisfied. And in their frustration, they want action. You'll see this young black man, this new generation, asking for the ballot or the bullet. That old Uncle Tom action is outdated. The young generation don't want to hear anything about the odds are against us. What do we care about odds? When this country here was first being founded, there were 13 colonies. The whites were colonized. They were fed up with this taxation without representation. So some of them stood up and said, "Liberty or death." Though I went to a white school over here in Mason, Michigan, the white man made the mistake of letting me read his history books. He made the mistake of teaching me that Patrick Henry was a patriot and George Washington wasn't nothing nonviolent about old Pat or George Washington. Liberty or death was what brought about the freedom of whites in this country from the English. They didn't care about the arts. Why, they faced the wrath of the entire British Empire. And in those days, they used to say that the British Empire was so vast and so powerful when the sun would never set on it. This is how big it was. Yet these 13 little scrawny states, tired of taxation without representation, tired of being exploited and oppressed and degraded, told that big British Empire, "Liberty or death." And here you have 22 million Afro-Americans, black people today, catching more hell than Patrick Henry ever saw. And I'm here to tell you, in case you don't know it, that you got a new generation of black people in this country who don't care anything whatsoever about us. They don't want to hear you, old Uncle Tom, handkerchief head, talking about the honor. No. This is a new generation. If they're going to draft these young black men and send them over to Korea or South Vietnam to face 800 million Chinese,
If you're not afraid of those odds, you shouldn't be afraid of these odds. Why is America, why does this loom to be such an explosive political year? Because this is the year of politics. This is the year when all of the white politicians are going to come into the Negro community. You never see them until election time. You can't blame them until election time. They're going to come in with false promises. And as they make these false promises, they're going to feed our frustrations. And this will only serve to make matters worse. I'm no politician. I'm not even a student of politics. I'm not a Republican, nor a Democrat, nor an American, and got sense enough to know it. I'm one of the 22 million black victims of the Democrats. One of the 22 million black victims of the Republicans, and one of the 22 million black victims of Americanism. And when I speak, I don't speak as a Democrat or a Republican. I speak as a victim of America's so-called democracy. You and I have never seen democracy. All we've seen is hypocrisy. When we open our eyes today and look around America, we see America not through the eyes of someone who has enjoyed the fruits of Americanism. We see America through the eyes of someone who has been the victim of Americanism. We don't see any American dream. We've experienced only the American nightmare. We haven't benefited from America's democracy. We've only suffered from America's hypocrisy. And the generation that's coming up now can see it and are not afraid to say it. If you go to jail, so what? If you're black, you were born in jail. If you black, you were born in jail. In the North as well as the South. Stop talking about the South. Long as you south of the Canadian border, you're South. Call Governor Wallace a Dixie governor. Romney is a Dixie governor. Yeah. 22 million black victims of Americanism are waking up, and they're gaining a new political consciousness, becoming politically mature. And as they become develop this political maturity, they're able to see the recent trends in these political elections. They see that the whites are so evenly divided that every time they vote, the race is so close they have to go back and count the votes all over again. And which means that any block, any minority that has a block of votes that stick together is in a strategic position. Either way you go, that's who gets it. You're in a position to determine who go to the White House and who stay in the doghouse. You're the one who has that power. You can keep Johnson in Washington, D.C., or you can send him back to his Texas cotton patch. You're the one who sent Kennedy to Washington. You're the one who put the present Democratic administration in Washington, D.C. The whites were evenly divided. It was the fact that you threw 80% of your votes behind the Democrats that put the Democrats in the White House. When you see this, you can see that the Negro vote is the key factor. And despite the fact that you are in a position to be the determining factor, what do you get out of it? The Democrats have been in Washington, D.C. only because of the Negro vote. They've been down there 4 years. And all other legislation they wanted to bring up, they brought it up and gotten it out of the way, and now they bring up you. And now they bring up you. You put them first, and they put you last. Because you're a chump. A political chump. In Washington, D.C., in the House of Representatives, there are 257 who are Democrats. Only 177 are Republicans. In the Senate, there are 67 Democrats. Only 33 are Republicans. The party that you back controls two-thirds of the House of Representatives and the Senate, and still they can't keep their promise to you, because you're a chump. Anytime you throw your weight behind a political party that controls two-thirds of the government and that party can't keep the promise that it made to you during election time, and you are dumb enough to walk around continuing to identify yourself with that party, you're not only a chump, but you're a traitor to your race. And what kind of alibi do they come up with? They try and pass the buck to the Dixiecrats. Now, back during the days when you were blind, deaf, and dumb, ignorant, politically immature, naturally you went along with that. But today, as your eyes come open and you develop political maturity, you're able to see and think for yourself. And you can see that a Dixiecrat is nothing but a Democrat in disguise. You look at the structure of the government that controls this country. It's controlled by 16 senatorial committees and 20 congressional committees. Of the 16 senatorial committees that run the government, 10 of them are in the hands of Southern segregationists. Of the 20 congressional committees that run the government, 12 of them are in the hands of Southern segregationists. And they're going to tell you and me that the South lost the war. Today are in the hands of a government of segregationists, racists, white supremacists, who belong to the Democratic Party but disguise themselves as Dixiecrats. A Dixiecrat is nothing but a Democrat. Whoever runs the Democrats is also the father of the Dixiecrats, and the father of all of them is sitting in the White House. You got a president who's nothing but a Southern segregationist. From the state of Texas. They'll lynch you in Texas as quick as they'll lynch you in Mississippi. Only in Texas they lynch you with a Texas accent. In Mississippi they lynch you with a Mississippi accent. And the first thing the cracker does when he comes in power, he takes all the Negro leaders and invites them for a coffee. To show that he's all right. And those Uncle Toms can't pass up the coffee. They come away from the coffee table telling you and me that this man is all right. Because he's from the South. And since he's from the South, he can deal with the South. And look at the logic that they're using. What about Eastland? He's from the South. Make him the president. He can, if Johnson is a good man because he's from Texas, and being from Texas will enable him to deal with the South, Eastland can deal with the South better than Johnson. Oh, I say, you've been misled. You've been had. You've been took. Washington a couple of weeks ago while the senators were filibustering, and I noticed in the back of the Senate a huge map, and on this map it showed the distribution of Negroes in America, and surprisingly the same senators that were involved in the filibuster were from the states where there were the most Negroes. Why were they filibustering the civil rights legislation? Because the civil rights legislation is supposed to guarantee voting rights to Negroes in those states. And those senators from those states know that if the Negroes in those states can vote, those senators are down the drain. The representatives of those states go down the drain. And in the Constitution of this country, it has a stipulation wherein whenever the rights, the voting rights of people in a certain district are violated, then the representative who's from that particular district, according to the Constitution, is supposed to be expelled from the Congress. Now, if this particular aspect of the Constitution was enforced, why, you wouldn't have a cracker in Washington, D.C. When you expel the Dixocrat, you're expelling the Democrat. When you destroy the power of the Dixocrat, you're destroying the power of the Democratic Party. So how in the world can the Democratic Party in the South actually side with you in sincerity when all of its power is based in the South? These Northern Democrats are in cahoots with the Southern Democrats. They play a giant con game, a political con game. You know how it goes. One of them comes to you and make believe it for you. And he's in cahoots with the other one that's not for you. Why? Because neither one of them is for you. But they got to make you go with one of them or the other. So this is a con game. And this is what they've been doing with you and me all these years. First thing Johnson got off the plane, when he became president, he asked, where's Dickie? You know who Dickie is? Dickie is old Southern cracker Richard Russell. Look here. Yes. Lyndon D. Johnson's best friend is the one who is ahead, who's heading the forces that are filibustering civil rights legislation. You tell me, how in the hell is he going to be Johnson's best friend? Can Johnson be his friend and your friend too? No, that man is too tricky. Especially if his friend is still old Dickie. Whenever the Negroes keep the Democrats in power, they're keeping the Dixocrats in power. This is true. A vote for a Democrat is nothing but a vote for a Dixocrat. I know you don't like me saying that, but person who come here to say what you like. I'm going to tell you the truth whether you like it or not. Up here in the North, you have the same thing. The Democratic Party don't do it that way. They got a thing that they call gerrymandering. They maneuver you out of power. Even though you can vote, they fix it so you vote for nobody. They got you going and coming. In the South, they're outright political wolves. In the North, they're political foxes. A fox and a wolf are both canine. Both belong to the dog family. Now, you take your choice. You're going to choose a Northern dog or a Southern dog. Because either dog you choose, I guarantee you, you'll still be in the doghouse. This is why I say it's the ballot or the bullet. It's liberty or death. It's freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody. America today finds herself in a unique situation. Historically, revolutions are bloody. Oh, yes, they are. They have never had a bloodless revolution or a nonviolent revolution. That don't happen even in Hollywood. You don't have a revolution in which you love your enemy. And you don't have a revolution in which you are begging the system of exploitation to integrate you into it. Revolutions overturn systems. Revolutions destroy systems. A revolution is bloody. But America is in a unique position. She's the only country in history in a position actually to become involved in a bloodless revolution. The Russian Revolution was bloody. Chinese Revolution was bloody. French Revolution was bloody. Cuban Revolution was bloody. And there was nothing more bloody than the American Revolution. But today, this country can become involved in a revolution that won't take bloodshed. All she's got to do is give the black man in this country everything that's doing. Everything. I hope that the white man can see this. Because if you don't see it, you're finished. If you don't see it, you're going to become involved in some action in which you don't have a chance. We don't care anything about your atomic bomb. It's useless. Because other countries have atomic bombs. When two or three different countries have atomic bombs, nobody can use it. So it means that the white man today is without a weapon. If you want some action, you got to come on down to Earth. And there's more black people on Earth than there are white people on Earth. I only got a couple more minutes. The white man can never win another war on the ground. His days of war victory, his days of ground victory are over. Can I prove it? Yes. Take all the action that's going on this earth right now that he's involved in. Tell me where he's winning. Nowhere. Why, some rice eaters ran him out of Korea. Yes, they ran him out of Korea. Race eaters with nothing but gym shoes and a rifle and a bowl of rice. Took him and his tanks and his napalm and all that other action he's supposed to have and ran him across the Yalu. Why? Because the day that he can win on the ground is past. Up in French Indochina, those little peasants, rice growers, took on the might of the French army and ran all the Frenchmen. You remember Dien Bien Phu? No! The same thing happened in Algeria, in Africa. They didn't have anything but a rifle. The French had all these highly mechanized instruments of warfare. But they put some guerrilla action on. And a white man can't fight a guerrilla warfare. Guerrilla action takes heart, takes nerve, and he doesn't have that. He's brave when he's got tanks. He's brave when he's got planes. He's brave when he's got bombs. He's brave when he got a whole lot of company along with him. But you take that little man from Africa and Asia, turn him loose in the woods with a blade. That's all he needs. All he needs is a blade. And when the sun comes down, goes down, and it's dark, it's even Stevens. It's the ballot or the bullet. Today our people can see that we're faced with a government conspiracy. This government has failed us. The senators who are filibustering concerning your and my rights, that's the government. Don't say it's Southern senators, this is the government. This is the government filibuster. It's not a segregationist filibuster. It's a government filibuster. Any kind of activity that takes place on the floor of the Congress or the Senate, that's the government. Any kind of dilly-dallying, that's the government. Any kind of pussy-footing, that's the government. Any kind of act that's designed to delay or deprive you and me right now of getting full rights, that's the government that's responsible. And any time you find the government involved in a conspiracy to violate the citizenship or the civil rights of a people, then you are wasting your time going to that government expecting redress. Instead, you have to take that government to the world court and accuse it of genocide and all of the other crimes that it is guilty of today.
So those of us whose political and economic and social philosophy is black nationalism have become involved in the civil rights struggle. We have injected ourselves into the civil rights struggle, and we intend to expand it from the level of civil rights to the level of human rights. As long as you fight it on the level of civil rights, you're under Uncle Sam's jurisdiction.
Right.
You're going to his court expecting him to correct the problem.
Right.
He created the problem.
Right.
He's the criminal.
Right.
You don't take your case to the criminal, you take your criminal to court.
Right.
When the government of South Africa began to trample upon the human rights of the people of South Africa, they were taken to the UN. When the government of Portugal began to trample upon the rights of our brothers and sisters in Angola, it was taken before the UN. Why, even the white man took the Hungarian question to the UN, and just this week, Chief Justice Goldberg was crying over 3 million Jews in Russia about their human rights, charging Russia with violating the UN Charter because of its mistreatment of the human rights of Jews in Russia. Now you tell me, how can the plight of everybody on this earth reach the halls of the United Nations, and you have 22 million Afro-Americans whose churches are being bombed, whose little girls are being murdered, whose leaders are being shot down in broad daylight? Now you tell me why the leaders of this struggle have never taken it before the United Nations. The entire civil rights struggle problem into the United Nations. And let the world see that Uncle Sam is guilty of violating the human rights of 22 million Afro-Americans, and Bill has the audacity or the nerve to stand up and represent himself as the leader of the free world. Not only is he a crook, he's a hypocrite. Here he is standing up in front of other people, Uncle Sam, with the blood of your and mine mothers and fathers on his hands, with the blood dripping down his jaws like a bloody jawed wolf. And still got the nerve to point his finger at other countries. You can't even get civil rights legislation. And this man has got the nerve to stand up and talk about South Africa, or talk about Nazi Germany, or talk about Portugal. No, no more days like those. So I say, in my conclusion, the only way we're going to solve it, we got to unite in unity and harmony. And black nationalism is the key. How are we going to overcome the tendency to be at each other's throats that always exists in our neighborhood? And the reason this tendency exists, the strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer. He keeps us divided in order to conquer us. He tells you I'm for separation and you for integration, and keep us fighting with each other. No, I'm not for separation and you're not for integration. What you and I are for is freedom. Only you think that integration will get you freedom. I think separation will get me freedom.
Right.
We both got the same objective. We just got different ways of getting at it.
Right.
So I studied this man, Billy Graham, who preaches white nationalism. That's what he preaches. I say that's what he preaches. The whole church structure in this country is white nationalism. You go inside a white church, that's what they're preaching, white nationalism. They got Jesus white, Mary white, God white, everybody white, that's white nationalism. So what he does, the way he circumvents the jealousy and envy that he ordinarily would incur among the heads of the church. Whenever you go into an area where the church already is, you're going to run into trouble. because they got that thing, what you call it, syndicated. They got a syndicate just like the racketeers have. I'm going to say what's on my mind, because the preachers already proved to you that they got a syndicate. And when you're out in the rackets, whenever you're getting in another man's territory, you know, they gang up on you. And that's the same way with you. You run into the same thing. So how Billy Graham gets around that, instead of going into somebody else's territory like he's going to start a new church, he doesn't try and start a church. He just goes in preaching Christ. And he says, everybody who believes in him, you go wherever you find him. So this helps all the churches, and so since it helps all the churches, they don't find him. Well, we're going to do the same thing, only our gospel is black nationalism. His gospel is white nationalism, our gospel is black nationalism. And the gospel of black nationalism, as I told you, means you should control your own, the politics of your community, the economy of your community, and all of the society in which you live should be under your control. And once you feel that this philosophy will solve your problem, go join any church where that's preached. Don't join a church where white nationalism is preached. Now, you can go to a Negro church and dispose of white nationalism. But when you walk in a Negro church and a white Mary and some white angels, that Negro church is preaching white nationalism. But when you go to a church and you see the pastor of that church with a philosophy and a program that's designed to bring black people together and elevate black people, join that church. Join that church. If you see where the NAACP is preaching and practicing that which is designed to make black nationalism materialize, join NAACP. Join any kind of organization, civic, religious, fraternal, political, or otherwise, that's based on lifting the black man up and making him master of his own community. It'll be the ballot, or it'll be the book. It'll be liberty, or it'll be death. And if you're not ready to pay that price, don't use the word freedom in your vocabulary. One more thing. I was on a program in Illinois recently with Senator Paul Douglas, a so-called liberal, so-called Democrat, so-called white man. At which time he told me that our African brothers were not interested in us in Africa. He says the Africans aren't interested in the American Negro. I knew he was lying. But during the next 2 or 3 weeks, it's my intention and plan to make a tour of our African homeland. And I hope that when I come back, I'll be able to come back and let you know how our African brothers and sisters feel toward us. And I know before I go there that they love us. We're one. We're the same. The same man who has colonized them all these years colonized you and me too all these years. And all we have to do now is wake up and work in unity and harmony, and the battle will be over. I want to thank the Freedom Now Party and the Goal. I want to thank Milton and Richard Henry for inviting me here this afternoon, and also Reverend Clegg. And I want them to know that anything that I can ever do at any time to work with anybody in any kind of program that is sincerely designed to eliminate the political, the economic, and the social evils that confront all of our people in Detroit and elsewhere, all they got to do is give me a telephone call and I'll be on the next jet right on into the city.
That was Malcolm X nearly 60 years ago on April 12th, 1964, speaking at the King Solomon Baptist Church on 14th and Marquette. And the speech has been labeled Ballots or Bullets. It is one of the signature speeches of the time period delivered by Malcolm X in the city of Detroit in 1964, some 60 years ago. And listening, of course, you can see the parallels to what is happening today. That's going to conclude our program. You've been listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast. If you'd like to have access to this program, just go to our website at the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. If you'd like to read the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. We'll close out with the music of Wes Montgomery, along with what the Wynton Kelly Trio at the Half Note in 1965. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful week.